I'm well, thanks. How are you guys? Good. Well, welcome. It's good to be back with you again. And I'll just raise a couple topics in brief before opening it up for questions. One, since we were last together, obviously there's been some work done on our proposal to change our tax system to make it more fair to Alaskans and get us more production. Since we last met, the experts who testified basically said this proposal puts Alaska back in the game from a competitive standpoint. So that's out there. Gasline, continue to be focused on getting Alaska's gas to Alaskans first. We've got that February 15 deadline on the Alaska Pipeline Project for their project concept selection. And then on the AGDC side, I've been working with the Representative Hawker's office and the Speaker's office to work through the legislation they've proposed, HB4, to get Alaska's gas to Alaskans through AGDC. Then another topic I just wanted to raise briefly is I'd like to see some more focus legislatively on reducing Alaskans' taxes. For instance, with the unemployment insurance contribution bill that I've got, Alaskans are paying more in their paychecks, and businesses, small businesses here, are paying more out of their own profits to fund an unemployment insurance fund that is solvent. And the legislation that I've proposed would actually require a determination of solvency be made, and if it's solvent, then give the Department of Labor Commissioner the authority to not raise those taxes, which are automatically raised right now, even though the fund is solvent. And then finally, today I'll be submitting legislation related to Division of Elections, and that's at the request of the Lieutenant Governor's Office. They oversee elections, as you know, under our Constitution. But one of the effective provisions of that bill would be to move the date of the primary from the fourth Tuesday in August to the second Tuesday in August of every even number year. And the purpose of moving that date is to assure that the Division of Elections can timely comply with law requiring the division to transmit ballots to military and overseas voters 45 days before the election. We've got an obligation to ensure that voters have access to the polls, especially those serving in uniform overseas. And so this measure will be submitted today for legislative consideration. With that, I'm just going to wrap up and open it up to questions so we have some time for that. So let's go ahead.
On that bill, has there been a problem getting ballots to people who are overseas, Alaskans who are overseas?
According to the Division of Elections, there has been. The time frame set, actually, the time frames are set by federal law, and they have had difficulty with that. It's put them under intense intense pressure that doesn't need to be if we move it back 2 weeks on the primary date. And that's frankly something I could refer you to the Lieutenant Governor's office on as well. Becky?
Governor, on oil taxes, I remember with HB 110, there was a lot of discussion about commitments from companies and what companies would invest if they got a tax cut on the order of HB 110. With your bill and talking about, you know, fairness to Alaskans and I guess looking at just the fairness issue in general, are you going to require commitments or certain levels of investment from companies as far as sort as a gauge, I guess, to if we do this or take this step, what are you willing to do in return?
See, this bill doesn't require that because by its very nature, the bill requires it. You don't get the full benefits of the bill and the tax benefits of the bill without investing in new production, whether you're in a legacy field or a new field. And so from that standpoint, the bill itself better protects Alaskans because we're taking less at the high oil prices and taking more at the lower oil prices. It focuses on new production, that second guiding principle, by utilizing that gross revenue exclusion for both existing fields and new fields. So I think by its very nature, that bill requires production in order to take full advantage of the bill. And frankly, I mean, at bottom, it's less risk on Alaska's treasury when those tax credits are gone, because next year, as I've already said, we're going to be paying out $1 billion in tax credits, And if oil prices go down, $90 a barrel, $80 a barrel, we don't have the cash revenue to cover those. So Alaska's treasury is at risk with the current way we pay tax credits that are not necessarily related to production.
Some of the industry, some representatives yesterday testified in the TAPS committee that, you know, the bill was a good starting point but didn't go far enough. I remember there was a tweet a couple weeks ago that you had that said extreme Democrats think it goes too far, not far enough, lends credibility to it being fair. So how far are you willing to move the needle from where you are right now on this bill as we move forward?
So I'll go back to the guiding principles on any proposed changes. And if it's fair to Alaskans, if it increases production, you know, if those the simplicity and restoring balance to the system, if it's competitive over the long run, those guiding principles will guide me in any changes that are proposed.
Yeah. Governor, on that point, you say they're not going to get the full benefit of the bill if they don't reinvest and increase production, but they will get the tax cut.
At high oil prices.
At high oil prices. Isn't that also going to impact state revenue? And why is it better to do it that way without any guarantees than to do it via credits?
Because it's not just about next year's state revenue. It's about long-term future for Alaska and Alaskans. And in this case, we've had expert testimony that it makes us competitive. We've had, by its very nature, the proposal better protects Alaskans at low oil prices in exchange for giving up some revenue at those high oil prices. And it's a trade-off. It's a balance. And what it says, as a state, we right now have $15, $16 billion in savings. We can manage a hit to the Treasury of about $500 million that's related to the lower tax rate, you know, for the next year or two or three while new production comes online. That's the goal. The goal is not to get to 10 years from now when there is when there's no cash left and production has continued to decline at 6% a year. Again, I keep going back to these guiding principles that if legislators want to propose something different, I'll keep an open mind to it. But they've got to meet these guiding principles that I've outlined.
Yeah. Mark Miller, Juneau Empire. A couple of senators in the majority, I'm thinking of Senators Faircloth and Stedman, have expressed some wariness of the idea of getting rid of progressivity from the production tax altogether. Why is getting rid of progressivity altogether a better alternative than simply perhaps a more progressive aspect?
So I go back to the system as a whole, not just that one element, because you can't look at one element of the system and say it's good or bad. It has to be taken in context of the whole. And when you combine progressivity at high oil prices like we have it now, it's clear that Alaska is not competitive, that we're an outlier when it comes to tax take. And that's one of the reasons why money is going to North Dakota, Texas. It's why their production has turned around and ours hasn't. I did see Senator Stedman's comments in your article this morning. And he expressed concern about where we have a 25% tax rate in the bill right now, and he's concerned that there's no progressivity feature which increases that rate effectively at higher oil prices. What he didn't say, it was kind of an incomplete statement, what he didn't say, because he's talking about how the percentage of state take at higher oil prices is less, and that's what he was arguing over, what he didn't say is that the protection for Alaskans is frankly, though, on the bottom end, that at lower oil prices, that percentage increases. So it's a balance for Alaskans to make us more competitive and create that opportunity. And to look at one feature and say, this doesn't work for me, kind of takes things out of context. And I'm glad that you asked the question so I could put it into a little better context.
Pat Forgy, Alaska Dispatch. Oil producers had earlier emphasized the need for protection at the low end to guarantee that their investments would be profitable. I don't think they anticipated oil prices would shortly thereafter hit $140 a barrel. But isn't this sort of giving them a do-over, letting them say, oh, actually, now we want protection at the high end?
No, I actually think I understand oil companies want it all and they can't have it all. You know, that's Alaskans' oil. And so I am better protecting Alaskans at lower oil prices with this proposal. And I think that's something we need to do.
On gas issues, Governor?
Yeah.
The House Energy Committee, week before last, I believe, or I'm sorry, last week, had kind of a difficult time getting an answer from Commissioner Sullivan on whether you would try to block imports of natural gas if Anchorage and South Central utility companies said that was their best alternative to keep their supply to where they need it to serve their customers. Would you do that? Would you try to block imports? And it also, there was a hearing yesterday afternoon where the Alaska Railroad said they've been approached by different business groups from the South asking them if they could ship containers of natural gas here. So it seems like someone's planning to ship gas here. Are you going to try and stop that if Anchorage is facing brownouts or blackouts?
No, if importing gas is the last resort, it's the last option to assure that Alaskans can heat their homes and provide electricity, of course not. What I've said is importing Canadian gas is a last resort, and there's a reason I said it that way, and that's because I don't want Alaskans to finance a competing project from Canada to export gas to the Pacific Rim and at the same time condemn Cook Inlet exploration and jobs. So what I've told, I've met with the utilities, I've met with the gas exploration companies in Cook Inlet, and what I've said is, utilities, make sure that you use Alaskans gas for Alaskans first before you look outside. And if you do look outside, you better not have gas exploration companies in Cook Inlet with their hands raised saying, I tried to sell gas to the utilities, but they wouldn't take it. And so I've been very, you know, we're going to make sure Alaskans are protected. At the same time, these are the utilities' business decisions they're making. And I'm staking ground for Alaskans and saying, Cook Inlet exploration and development of gas is important. Keeping the lights on is important as well. And I've never said never. I've said it's a last resort.
And do you support
Rich? Let's go.
Rich. Hi, Governor. Different subject. Yesterday, you ordered Flagler to have staff for a former legislator who you note worked across the state and practiced law in many communities across the state. One of those was the North Slope Borough, where he was a critical functionary in providing the means for the raiding of the North Slope Borough Treasury of hundreds of millions of dollars by corrupt contractors, mm-hmm. borough officials, and lobbyists. Is there anyone who doesn't deserve that honor of a half staff, and for which he faced trial in Fairbanks on four federal counts of fraud? Is there anyone who should not have that honor of a half staff? Would you say the same for the VECO defendants?
Rich, I was unaware of that,
okay.
And certainly I would have had concerns about it. The recognition that you just described is a courtesy that is customarily extended to every House member who passes and every Senate member who passes. I was unaware of that, and you know, would appreciate you bringing it to my attention. So, given that, I appreciate you setting the record straight. So, you had another question?
Do you support House Bill 4, Governor?
I support House Bill 4 amended. So, here, kind of with House Bill 4, that's the AGDC pipeline effort. I've said in my State of the State speech that I thought it was appropriate and important to Alaska's interest in gas to boost AGDC as a corporation and to increase its ability to build a gas line or participate in building one. House Bill 4, as originally filed, I had concerns with, and I made those concerns known to Rep. Hawker's office and to the Speaker. Those concerns centered around requiring AGDC accountability for the people's money. So I said I want to see Executive Budget Act coverage in there. They centered around providing accountability for AGDC related to bonding and the state's credit, because the original bill gave AGDC limitless authority to issue moral obligation debt. I don't think that's appropriate. I asked them to provide better protections for Alaskan consumers. I told them I wanted to see AGDC accountability for cost of service to consumers. I said that I wanted to see DNR accountability in decision-making over royalty gas, so all Alaskans derive maximum benefit from that gas, not giving that royalty gas to AGDC. I was going to leave that decision with DNR. And I spoke with them about accountability for governance in the state's interest, having to do with composition of the board. So those, it's a large bill, but, and that's why I have notes here about what kind of the big picture areas I've covered. I understand that they had a sponsor substitute in motion, ahead of getting a detailed list of concerns from me, but. So I haven't taken a look at whatever might be out there in the last 24 or 48 hours. But those are the concerns that I expressed.
So if they don't add all or most of those, would you oppose the bill? Would you veto the bill? If it's passed as it is now, would you veto it? No changes
so
at all?
I cannot support, and I would not support, the original bill as filed. I've not seen anything after that. They know that. And I have to just tell you, they are working with our office and with every legislator in the building who's interested in that topic to boost AGDC's ability to get Alaska's gas to Alaskans. Adam?
On education, there's some folks back in Anchorage in that school district who are critical of what they say is not enough funding within the BSA, that yes, while money's going to retirements and other things, but the classroom sizes are getting bigger because of a lack of funding to the BSA. What do you have to say about that? And also, is there a time frame you have in terms of, you talked about in the state of the state, just going from 70% graduation rate to 90%. What's your time frame for that? And what would you say about this lack of BSA funding?
So our goal is to get to a 90% graduation rate within a decade. I mean, that's the goal. With respect to the BSA increase that's been requested, I would say a couple things. One is that including the FY14 budget proposal we've made, the last three budget proposals combined have increased funding for K-12 education by $245 million, far greater than the cost of inflation to the school districts. You mentioned retirements. That includes TERS funding and TERS, that includes TERS funding as well. But the bottom line is, we've got a system that is continually asking for more and more money. We give it more and more money, in this case, $245 million more. The budget we submitted this year is, you know, over $1.5 billion for K-12 education. And we, as legislators and as governor, are simply asking for results for Alaskans' kids. And we recognize that that can take different forms. We're looking to professional educators to tell us what those can look like and what those results can look like. As it is, you know from our previous discussions that, you know, last year, for example, when we gave $25 million and we proposed $25 million more for increased heating costs, Alaskans know what they're buying for that $25 million. They're buying that increased heating cost, and they're leaving $25 million more dollars for the classroom that would have had to go to those heating costs. Now, does that help with the graduation requirement? I think so, because there's more money for the classroom that would have gone towards heating costs. But I think we can do better than that. And these are discussions that we're having, you know, in this Capitol right now with legislators on how to do that. Rich?
Other than issues related to wardrobe and gear, do you have any thoughts on the president's nomination for Interior Secretary?
Other than that, I think we have
Well, maybe those are the main things.
I don't know. Well, I've got something in common with her. I've got an RAI membership number too. So I'm looking forward to meeting the new secretary and striking up a conversation on behalf of Alaskans. And we'll see where that goes.
Is that it? No.
I don't know the person. Okay. I have no background on the person other than what you've just mentioned, other than one news article. So I'm going to leave it up my REI membership number right now. Yeah.
Matt Buxton, Fairbanks Daily News Miner. During the first hearing for House Bill 4, Speaker Chenault mentioned or there's a question was raised of what happens if during the open season we end up with more than half a B of gas, which would be above the AGEA agreement.
That'd be good news.
So I mean, what happens at that point? Do we say sorry to that other 0.2 B, or is that part of a discussion of do we need to get out of AGEA, or what's the result if we get more than?
I think that'd be good news, but here's the issue. AGDC has done a good job of meeting its regulatory requirements and getting an EIS done. They don't have gas, but that's what you're addressing. Over on the Alaska Pipeline Project, they've got gas, and they've got a pipeline builder. The design right now is to merge those two projects and to try to bring them together. That may be one of those moments when the projects will come together. It could come together before that, during that, or after that, but that's the nature of a commercial transaction, that those alignments get made, the project morphs, but we're pushing forward to build this pipeline one way or the other. She doesn't have a chance yet. So.
Sorry, a quick question about this morning in Senate Education Committee, we heard from a bunch of engineers and UAA and UAF about the funding for the engineering facilities at UAA and UAF. And before the hearing, I thought that I had heard that they had had enough money so that they didn't need an appropriation until next year. But they're saying now that they're going to run out of the funding in January for the UAF facility, and it will cause construction delays if they don't get more funding this year. Had you heard that? Or
I had not heard that. I'll put that in the context of fiscal restraint and just say that we've got some choices ahead as a legislature and as governor when it comes to capital projects and when it comes to the operating budget. And I spoke in the last week with the president of the Senate and his finance chairs, and the speaker of the House and his finance chairs, asked each of them to join me in a spending limit, asked each of them to join me in a five-year fiscal plan to be developed. So engineering facilities, operating budget expenditures, for me, are all going to be within the context of getting us to a more sustainable level of spending, because new production will still be a few years off.
The people who testified today said that getting those facilities built and with no delays is critical production.
Those are decisions that legislators can make within the context of whatever spending limits they ascribe to themselves. Ideally, those would be set with me, but you know, every Senate, every House sets their own when they pass the bill. You know, and sometimes they move when the other body moves. But those priorities get to be established by legislators in the appropriations process, and that's where this discussion is being had right now.
Okay.
But I had not heard that about that specific facility.
So it's not a priority for you to keep these projects on schedule?
I didn't say that. I said that what I am saying is that the legislature is the appropriate place for those discussions to be had. We'll join in those discussions. I would be satisfied if they passed the budget that I proposed. Obviously, I wouldn't have proposed it if I didn't think we could make it work. At the same time, this is new information to me, and I need to consider it. So.
Governor, we need to go online.
Okay, go ahead.
Operator, we're ready for online Q&A. Could you take us off lecture mode?
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press star one. Andrew, go ahead with your question, please.
Yeah, Governor Sean Parnell, Andrew Rogers, KSRM. You've mentioned a lot about capital spending, kind of reining that in, but are there any plans within this five-year fiscal plan to maybe look at the operational budget as well and see what we can do to lean back or make that more sustainable for the future as well?
I mentioned both operating and capital. Both are extremely important in terms of creating a sustainable level of spending. This year, for example, you don't see it in the paperwork that we gave to the legislature, but for example, there was a $40 million absorption of increased costs because merit increases by statute go up every 2 years. We ate it, we didn't ask for more. I didn't put forward hundreds of millions, if not billions, in the last 3 years of operating requests and capital requests that come forward. So the answer is yes. We are working to restrict the growth and to cut the operating budget spending. We're doing the same with the capital budget. It all spends, and savings will run out without new production coming, and we don't want to be in that position. So absolutely, that's why I've requested a spending limit, which will be upon both the operating and the capital budgets from legislators. Yes, we're still online. Anybody else online?
What's your question? Lainey, go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, Governor. Lainey Welch here from Kodiak. This is regarding House Bill 80, the cruise ship discharges. What do you say to the Alaska citizens who successfully pushed for discharge limits by initiative in 2006? And what do you say to the seafood industry, which has worked for two decades to create a brand based in part on Alaska's clean and pristine waters, especially when Alaskans won't even know where these discharges are occurring?
I would say that I would not propose a bill that I thought would damage our environment. I would say that the standards to which cruise ships are currently being held and will continue to be held with their advanced wastewater treatment systems are among or surpass the most stringent in the world. I would say that DEC's ability to regulate and to regulate in accordance with federal and state law and the stipulations that they put on the mixing zones that you're referring to require that species not be harmed. So I would just say that voters were likely unaware that there is no technology available, and the Science Advisory Panel concluded this as well. There's no technology available that would meet the point of discharge standard that has been set. So in the balance of protecting the environment and assuring that our small businesses can still get the benefit of a million cruise ship passengers spending money in our economy, we're making sure that cruise ships will continue to be held to high standards, that the environment will continue to be protected, and that our businesses will continue to grow. So that's what I would tell you, Lainey. Rich?
On the same subject, Holland America, Norwegian lines, both have advanced systems that do have the ability to remove some of the last remaining substances in the water, copper, ammonia, the other heavy metals. They don't always meet the standard of the 2006 initiative, but they meet it a lot more often than the ships that don't have these advanced treatment facilities. In other words, specifically the ion exchange or reverse osmosis. Wouldn't it be better to have a law that says that delays implementation extends the delay of implementation of the 2006 initiative for another period of time to allow trials of these even more technologically sophisticated treatment facilities that have shown to not work, 100% of the time, but to be better than the effluent without these systems?
No, we did that once before, and the legislature set up the panel, the Science Advisory Panel, to address those topics. They concluded there is nothing available now to meet that standard. And let me just ask, do we have a person from DEC here?
Yeah.
Can you come up here, please, and just speak to this? You've had much more water quality issues than I have.
Thank you, Governor. My name is Lynn Kent. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Department of Environmental Conservation. And through an earlier science advisory panel, a conference conducted by DEC before the most recent panel was established in 2009. And with the current science advisory panel and a workshop that they conducted, the conclusion of all of that work has been that the advanced wastewater treatment systems that are on board cruise ships right now are really the best that there is. They do a very good job. They treat all of the wastewater that's discharged in Alaska to a standard that meets all of Alaska's water quality standards, with the exception of just four criteria. And even with the legislation that's pending right now, DEC has authority to continue to look at new technologies that may become available in the future and to push cruise ships to continue to do better with their wastewater discharge.
Thanks, Lynn. Thank you. Were we still online? Okay. Yeah. Online? Okay. Here?
There are no more questions online.
Okay. Bob?
You said that DEC is going to make sure that marine species are not harmed. How are they going to do that with a mixing zone that they're not measuring? They've said repeatedly in testimony that the dilution factor is going to make the water quality meet standards, but dilution doesn't make those four heavy metals go away.
Lynn, I'm going to call you out. Because I know you have the power to regulate that, and you already do.
Well, they do, but there's not going to be any testing. How are you going to assure
that's
that?
That's not true, that there won't be any testing. But go
I ahead. Believe it is, though. Ms. Kent said in the hearings that they're not going to test the, there's no way to test the edge of the moving mixing zone.
Okay.
Is that not true, then? Are you going to do any testing on mixing zones?
Thank you, Governor. there's a host of questions there, but...
But the main one was, how are you going to make sure that those marine species are protected, even though, while being diluted, there's going to be continual flow of heavy metals into the environment?
And how do we currently do it with the others?
Right, thank you. Well, the water quality standards are designed to protect species in the water body. And they're based on a concentration of a particular contaminant in a water body. So when a cruise ship is moving at 6 knots or greater, we have calculated through some studies that the dilution factor is 50,000 to 1. And what that means is that within seconds of discharge from a moving cruise ship, the water quality standards that are protective of aquatic life are met. And when we say we can't measure that, it's because we couldn't get close enough to a cruise ship fast enough to actually take a sample in the water body. But given the concentration in the effluent that's discharged, the standards are met so quickly that we couldn't measure that portion. We do monitor, as the governor said, we require the cruise ships that discharge in Alaska to take samples twice a month for some parameters, daily for other parameters. So there's a tremendous amount of monitoring that goes on.
But that's dilution. You apparently are going to let the ships do this for several years, since you say there's no new technology on the horizon. So how is the cumulative impact on these species, and especially on things like the new gooey duck farms that the industry is trying to open up every place that Fish and Game allows them? How are you going to measure any cumulative impact on marine species?
Thank you again for your question. The mixing zone regulations that apply to all of the wastewater discharges in the state first require that the facility, shore-based facility or cruise ship, treat to really the best standards that they're able to treat to. So the requirement for mixing zone is that the mixing zone has to be as small as possible, and that there can be no lethality to passing organisms, no toxic effects on aquatic life, no impact to fisheries or processing. There's a 19-part test that any facility that wants to get a mixing zone has to go through, and it's a regulatory test. Mixing zones are only authorized in the context of a wastewater discharge permit, and all of those permits are they're renewed on a 5-year basis, and they go through a public review and comment process.
And the question was, how are you going to measure the impacts? Those are your standards, but how are you going to measure to see that they're being achieved?
The modeling, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, we generally do that through modeling for those facilities that have a fixed shore-based facility. Some of those permits require in-the-water monitoring at the edge of the mixing zone to just verify that the models are accurate. And we do very well with the models. These are models that are used around the country. They're not something we just invented here in Alaska.
And how about for cruise ships? You said that applies to shore-based. The issue here is cruise ships.
The same thing applies to cruise ships, right, in terms of how to monitor?
It does. For those that are...
Go ahead.
One more comment. For the very few cruise ships that are authorized to discharge right now in port, when they are stationary. The mixing zone for those cruise ships under the current law is very small. It's within meters of the vessel. We have the ability to either require the companies to monitor at the edge of those mixing zones or to do it ourselves. We haven't seen a need to do that in the water body because of the tremendous amount of dilution, even when they're at port.
Although there are limitations on that as well. We're going to wrap up. Does anybody have a question on the last topic that we may not have covered yet? No, you've got plenty today. Go ahead, Adam.
I do have one more. It's a little off this topic. So,
what is the topic?
There was actually, it's on the environment, a group called the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. They are claiming that an immediate action plan that was issued by a sub-cabinet created a few years ago on climate change, they say that action plan was never, at least wasn't released to the public. They kind of claim that the sub-cabinet went away. It was established during the previous administration. Do you know anything about that?
Certainly, I'm familiar with the work of the sub-cabinet beforehand. I can also tell you that some of that work has continued, not necessarily in terms of the formal meetings of the cabinet, but Village of Newtok has continued to move. We've continued to work towards getting an evacuation route for Kivalina because of coastal erosion there, stringent permitting and the like. But as far as I know, that's an accurate statement that they made related to no meeting of that climate sub-cabinet, but those issues are taken up every day in what those agencies do. So,
can I ask a related question? Just one last one. Do you believe that there is that global warming is occurring, climate change is occurring, and if you do, do you believe that there's a human cause to at least a portion of it?
Of course. I mean, climate change is occurring.
Right.
It's clear that the climate changes. It changes mm-hmm. in cycles. Mm-hmm. It's also clear that humans have a part in that. It's also clear that natural elements like volcanoes have an even huger, more significant impact mm-hmm. on that. So the answer is yes, but I think it's arrogant of an individual to think that I can impact the climate myself. And bottom line is humans impact the climate, as do natural causes.
But does the state then have a role or responsibility to reduce the production of greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, which do affect climate change?
The state has a responsibility to protect the health of its citizens by constitution. That can take a number of different forms, and that's about as far as I go with the answer.
Thanks.
All right, thank you all.
Thank you.